Welcome to Jaguars This Week, presented by Aetna.
Got it. Caught! Touchdown! Oh, my gosh! How did that happen? He got it from 59 yards away for the win!
Jaguars This Week, presented by Aetna, is brought to you by Ticket Exchange, Community First Credit Union, Carrie Limousine, Wachovia, Sunny's Barbecue, and by Everbank. Jaguars This Week begins right now.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Jaguars This Week. Live from Everbank Field in Jacksonville, I'm Brian Sexton. Jeff Loggeman's across the table. John Osher is here. Joe Fortunato. Philly's in first place, and he's wearing a purple shirt, folks. Go figure.
Barney Day.
Good to see you, Barney.
I love you. You love me. Am I singing the right song there, Joe?
Yeah. Glad you know that.
All right, so to get caught up to speed here, there seemed to be a groundswell of optimism leading towards the owners' meetings on Tuesday. They're supposed to be Tuesday, Wednesday. They finished up their business yesterday. Now there's a pin that is starting to present itself that could pop the balloon, and that is revenue sharing. So let's talk about optimism first, and then let's talk about impediments to a deal getting done. First of all, for each of you, based on what you've seen the last week or so, do you see it coming? Are you optimistic? Or is this just a lot of chatter? You know, is it smoke or fire?
Well, I'm optimistic that, you know, basically what I've thought since this whole thing started, I don't think they're going to miss games. I think people...
Are you saying regular season or preseason and regular season?
Regular season. I mean, maybe a preseason game if the logistics and the timing just don't work. But I don't think people do things without a deadline and without pressure to do it. And I've always thought, you know, between mid-June and mid-July, when they see it coming down the pike that they're going to lose, and when I say they being the players, when they're going to lose one of those 16 game checks, they ain't going to want it to happen. And when the owners see they're going to lose the big, big regular season money gates, they don't want it to happen. So I'm optimistic because you keep hearing things that sort of play into that time frame. Jeff may feel differently.
No, I mean, I feel good about it. I mean, I feel that, you know, the more they talk, the better it is. But, you know, do I have any predictions? I mean, I've been asked that question so many times, you know, around town. And am I walking around with the Johnny Carson Schwami hat, you know? I mean,
no, but we publicized on the show.
How do you know? I mean, how do you really know? I mean,
but you're the one guy who's been involved in these before.
There are so many things that could make it happen tomorrow, and there are things that could just totally screw it up, you know. And I'm kind of at the point now where I think a lot of people are, and that we're tired of hearing about it. We're tired of reading about it. The only thing that we want to read about is when it's done, you know.
Right, so revenue
sharing. Get the ball rolling, you know.
Revenue sharing is what got them off track in 06 and created the deal that's created the lockout.
Well, and
can they get over that revenue sharing, or is there still a fundamental flaw between the owners and big market, small market, big revenue, small revenue markets that has to be traversed before we're getting anywhere?
Well, I don't necessarily think that has to be there in order for the deal to get done. And the reason I say that, what's coming out of these sessions basically is the information that the player cut would go to 48%, where historically it's been anywhere from 50 to 52 point something, whatever it is. And if you break down the numbers, if the owners keep an extra, you know, 2% or 3%, that could mean 7 to 10 to $12 million in current money for each team. You know, is that enough money for the small market teams to say, you know, hey, I can live with that, provided that, you know, we grow the revenue package in the future? Probably so. The big question, I think, becomes when you talk about revenue sharing is this: the floor, the hard floor that they're talking about in discussions with the players, and that it would require all teams to spend a certain amount of money. And I think the number that's been thrown around is 90%. And so if that's 90%, let's say the cap for round purposes is, you know, $200 million, that means Wayne Weaver would have to spend $180 million. Is that a viable number for a small market franchise? I don't know the answer to that question.
You know
Wayne certainly does.
Right.
But having that 48% instead of 50, 51, 52 certainly would, I think, make that 90% figure more palatable. But is it good enough? I don't know that. You know,
we don't know the rules yet.
We don't know the numbers.
Right.
You know, I just know that in the past, you and I have been told, as well as John, you probably heard this in Indianapolis about small market teams, and that if they sell their tickets, then they'll be okay.
Right.
But here's the thing. Can you sell the tickets? You know, here we are in a year in which there's been a lockout and ticket sales have been very slow. Can you get back on track? Have you lost anything with this lockout? So in my mind, if you could have done it before by just selling tickets, you can certainly do it from my estimation on what their numbers that are being thrown about now.
Here's what I heard, and it caught my attention yesterday. I heard Mike Florio from Pro Football Talk talking on a station in Tampa when I was over there. And he said that they're talking about the overall revenue envelope being $18 billion in the next 10 years. That is an enormous growth.
I'd like to know where they're talking about getting this additional money because, I mean, I want to renegotiate. You
but
too,
can,
Joe.
Can Jackson,
John,
can Jackson,
Brian?
If it goes to $18 billion, can Jacksonville survive just by selling tickets? That's
well, I mean, they're going to grow up to $18 billion on things that are shared. I mean, that $18 billion is not coming from, you know, stadium naming rights and you know, signage. That's not where that $18 billion they're talking about
but
is going to come
you
from.
You keep reading the word unshared
revenue. Yeah, but, I mean, the unshared revenue, I mean, compared to what that $18 billion number is mostly built up of, everything else is relatively small potatoes.
Right.
But, I mean, you're talking about having – you know, the Thursday night package be sold off, new TV deals being negotiated. That's where that $18 billion is coming from. And that number is mostly made up of quote-unquote shared revenue that's currently being shared now. But there's no question there will be some team that's going to say,
Dan Snyder's going to push it.
Hey, you know, there's a way to get more, and the way to get more is to go to a different market, and then that's going to be where L.A. comes in and, you know, that talk, it's just not going to ever end until there's a team there. And, you know, could there be two there? Don't know. Could there be end up being two teams in other markets? Maybe. It's going to be interesting to see kind of where it goes, you know. But I think the most important thing now is people want their football, and so do I.
Yeah. All right. Now, how about you? Revenue sharing. How does that play in according to your perspective?
Well, you know, somebody said today I was talking to, it's never going to be a situation where the small market owners are happy. I shouldn't say happy, but where the small market owners aren't up against it compared to the big market owners.
Right.
But it seems to have gotten to the point now where it, for a lot of these owners and perhaps Jacksonville included, it's going to be better to sort of bite the bullet and be a little unhappy and get this thing going and getting the momentum back. And so are they going to be thrilled with whatever formula has come up with, whatever they're up against? No, but
they live with it.
It will be something, it seems to be getting close now to something they can live with. So
nobody's ever going to be completely happy.
Right.
If everybody's happy, I mean,
but
what's the world coming to?
I'm with you on that, but the chances of this team or Buffalo or one of the small market teams being that team that, all right, well, they're unhappy, so they're going to be that portion that's really unhappy. I mean, that's really likely. Mm-hmm. That these small market teams, you know, the Buffaloes, Jacksonville's, Oakland, San Diego, they're the ones who are going to be unhappy. And so, you know, what's the relative strength of that unhappiness, and can they live with it, and can they grow and survive with it? We got to look at it from that perspective, because Jeff said it. Until there's teams in L.A., Jacksonville is always going to be under the microscope. Growing at $18 billion means Jacksonville's got to grow, too, because they're going to have to create some of that revenue to make it up on their own.
Correct.
It just is a big puzzle to put together right now.
It is.
Well, as long as the model that they finally settle in on allows, you know, those small market teams that you mentioned, if they can live with it, not that we want them to be unhappy, but if they can live with it, then that's good.
I don't think that
And I think the key to that is the number that we talked about is that floor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, that number for the minimum expenditure for player cost. If that floor becomes tough to meet, then the small market teams cannot compete. If it stays at a reasonable level and if the shared revenue continues to grow, small market teams can do fine.
I don't think that Wayne will sign off or vote for a plan this time around that doesn't work for the Jaguars.
He's not going to. I don't think him or any other owner
right.
will cast a vote this time around just to show solidarity.
And if it's as imbalanced as what you say, it's going to be imbalanced for other teams as well.
Sure.
I don't think this time it won't be great for the small market teams, but I can't imagine that they're going to get enough owners to sign off on something that won't work this time around. I could be wrong, but there doesn't seem to be that vibe of, hey, let's push it through this time.
Like Loggy said, we don't know yet. We're still waiting. Let's take a break. As we go, we'll remind you to register your kids age 6 through 14 for the 8th annual Jaguars Got Skills Camp. Jaguars coaches and alumni players will teach the fundamentals of the game and the value of teamwork. Jackson DeVille, the Roar, will be on hand and water and snacks provided. Each participant will receive a goodie bag, certificate, and T-shirt. The 8th annual Jaguars Got Skills Camp has been rescheduled for July 22nd and is sponsored by Shoe Carnival, Sargento, and Winn-Dixie. Register at Shoe Carnival or on Jaguars.com. More to come after this on News Talk Radio, WOKV. Depend on it. Well, the Jaguars will host the first ever movie night at Everbank Field Friday, June 24th at 8:30. You'll see The Blind Side starring Sandra Bullock on the scoreboard at Everbank Field from the field or south end zone seats. Of course, you'll only see it if you're a season ticket owner. Gates open at 7:30. Discounted merchandise and concessions available, including $2 draft beer.
$2 beer.
You'll need a ticket to enter, so call 633-2000 to enjoy the show. Sexton, Loggeman, Osher, Fortunato. How are you?
I wanted to ask John, how was the evening with the coaches last week?
It was good. It was, it's something that this team does that I haven't heard a whole lot of other teams doing. And, you get a lot of insight into sort of how these guys think. There's always some tape breakdown. There's some, there's some good explanation of sort of how they work and what they look for when they're analyzing a player.
How many coaches were there? Four or five?
I want to say it was four. Del Rio, Biner.
Duffner.
Duffner and Cullen were there.
Okay.
So it's certainly worth it's worth going to if you have access to it.
And how many people ballpark came? A couple hundred?
Yeah, the room where it is, it's the
Touchdown Club.
Touchdown Club is full. And it's just a good off-season get-together for the fan. I mean, if you like football and are passionate about this team, I always learn something when I go to them.
Yeah.
So,
That's good. I mean,
I like it.
Having things like that, the people of Jacksonville, they don't do that kind of thing in other markets.
Right.
I mean, that's the impressive thing about it. In fact, the Medicine Miracles dinner that we would have at Morton's, you had almost the entire Jaguars coaching staff. This was last year in June. Almost the entire coaching staff and every big name player that there was waiting on your table.
Yeah. Right.
And it was tremendous boost for Children's Miracle Network fundraising wise. And I remember talking to people that were there and I said, this just doesn't happen anywhere else.
It feels like Green Bay on a smaller level.
It doesn't happen. I mean,
it would never even get thought about in Indianapolis.
Like, no.
Wouldn't even be a factor.
I think, I think the event raised, approximately $60,000, somewhere in that range. And if that event were in a New York, a Chicago, a D.C.
Well, even in India, to St. Elmo's
Steakhouse. Yeah. I mean, can you imagine?
Right.
I mean, it would raise significantly more money because, there's a little bit more, business that would be willing to pony up more money for the tables and such. But, I mean, Jacksonville should be very appreciative of the things that this organization has done, because I've seen the flip side of that where certain organizations, like one that I was with in New York, they didn't do anything.
Right.
Like
they didn't
that.
Think they had to.
No.
It's interesting that you bring that up because You know, a couple years ago when the firemen showed up for the Oklahoma drill, and I know you're getting pummeled with the Oklahoma drill.
People love it.
But the firemen showed up, and they raised their ladder, and the firemen were all sitting up the ladder, which was cool. And then they had an American flag hanging there, and it was a hot summer night. It felt like, you know, a Norman Rockwell painting. It felt like what they do in Green Bay. It's what how the team and the fans can touch one another. Mm-hmm. And you don't see that in a lot of other markets.
Right. And people give me, I mean, you know, there's been some kidding back and forth in the Ozone about the Oklahoma drill. And, you know, people have accused me of not liking it. I'm looking forward to seeing it. And we're having some fun with it. And people are getting kind of angry that I haven't given a whole lot of credence. I think it's going to be fun to watch. And I'm kind of withholding my judgment until I see it. And I'm looking forward to seeing the atmosphere. And there's obviously a lot of excitement about it. And you know, I think it's going to be fun to watch.
Great drill.
355 NFL drill. 1. Are you going to get to make the selections this year?
I think John should make the selections.
I don't know that I'm worthy of making the selections yet, since I don't know about it.
I'll make them.
I'll pass it on to you, and if the fans deem me worthy, then I'll make them next year. How about that?
I don't know if I'd get very many of my requests because I'd have a few more highliners in there.
You know, we got about 2 minutes left before we break for news at the bottom of the hour.
You missed a good show last week.
I was just about to ask about that. I heard from a bunch of people that you had a great conversation with David Yost.
David Yost, the offensive coordinator, Missouri Tigers, and obviously he was also the quarterback's coach. Good interview, and, I mean, holy cow, for a minute there I thought it was going to be a one question a segment. I mean, the guy just went on and on and on. I mean, he's wonderful.
Right. He loves his guy.
I mean, he loves his guy, and you know, I give him credit because, you know, I think last week I'd completed six games of watching Blaine Gabbert, and then obviously everything that he has done that has been filmed also, you know, combine, whatever. And I really thought after watching him, I came away extremely impressed. I mean, he's got everything. I mean, he's got all the tools. He's got the mechanics. He's athletic. He's got a cannon for an arm. And the only thing that I really came away from watching was if there was any type of weakness at all, it was the deep ball. It was the touch on the deep ball. And I remember that's in my mind. It's in my notes. And I asked David, Coach Yost, if Blaine had a weakness, what do you think that it would be? He went right there. And he said that, you know, if there's one thing that he probably needs to work on is the deep ball. And he actually explained that he'd lost a couple receivers from the year before, probably didn't have the comfort level throwing the deep ball, but something that he felt that he could improve on. But, I mean, out of everything that I watched, I mean, that was it. I mean, this guy – Brian, I'm telling you, when he set his feet, which mechanically flawless, when he set his feet and unleashed that cannon, his fastball, he could put it on a rope and put it on the money every time.
Somebody told me, not from this organization, that they thought that if he fulfilled his potential, he had the ability, he looked like a Troy Aikman, John Elway kind of guy in terms of
more of an arm. More of an arm than Troy.
Okay.
You know,
maybe not as mobile as Elway.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. You know, John was probably one of the most mobile quarterbacks that I ever went against, personally.
Right.
And John, the tough part about John was is that he a lot of times would look to throw when he was mobile. His eyes always stayed down the field, and Blaine's got a lot of that in him. You know, when he tucks it and runs it, very, very few times does he just tuck it and run it because – he wants to. It's because that's his last option. You know, his eyes stay down the field almost exclusively, and he's looking to find somebody to throw the ball to.
We got a break for news. Let's talk football when we come back. Yeah. It's a whole lot more fun.
Football.
Yeah, and I did. I watched today William Rackley.
Okay.
Lehigh University guard/tackle. I watched every game that was available. 5 games of William Rackley today.
Cool. We'll talk about William Rackley, more Blaine Gabbert, and if you have a thought, 355-NFL-1. You're listening to Jaguars This Week, presented by Aetna, live from Everbank Field in Jacksonville on News Talk Radio, WOKV. Depend. Welcome back. Jaguars This Week rolls along. About 23 minutes left in the program. You can join us, 355-NFL, 1-800-355-6351. We teased you at the beginning of the news that we would come back and talk about William Rackley, who played offensive tackle at Lehigh, but projects as a guard in the National Football League. So, Loggy, your thoughts on this guy?
Yeah, he played left tackle at Lehigh. There were 6 games that I was able to watch. Villanova, Lafayette, Harvard, Bucknell and I can't remember the other team. Anyway, out of those six games, I saw one time that he got beat. One time. He gave up a sack to number nine, whoever that is, against Villanova. That's it. I mean, other than that, the guy was dominant, as you'd expect him to be at that level, you know, against opponents like that. But very quick, very low, got good feet, pretty good-sized body. I mean, clearly looks like a guard when you look at his combine video. The thing that impressed me most was the way he finished. He was always looking to bury guys, always looking to finish, and if his guy got buried or wasn't there, he never went and just stood around the pile. He always would look for an opposite-colored jersey and go to him. Got great hands as far as getting him inside and just the strength that he has. His strength overmatched most of the guys at that level. He had this one hit against a Bucknell linebacker when he was actually pulling from the tackle position and came to his right, to the right side, and he hammered this linebacker. And it was a big linebacker, not a typical size linebacker for that level. He crushed him, crushed him. And he actually played a little bit of guard, left guard, against Harvard. And it was kind of, I was like, what? What is he doing at guard? The guy that normally plays left guard was kind of a stiff, and so they couldn't pull him, and so they'd move Rackley to guard, and he would always pull every time. I mean, what a key for a defender.
Right.
I mean, it's going to be a – he's pulling every time, but the problem was you didn't know whether it was a run or a pass. Very quick, plays low, strong, good hands. You know, he's just got a – he's probably going to have a little bit of an adjustment period because he's not going to be playing against Bucknell and Harvard. But a good pickup.
Does it help that he's going to guard? Does it get easier because he's going to play a position that doesn't require him to?
It probably helps at the same time, but, I mean, still he's got to learn the new footwork of playing guard. And, obviously, you know, the guys that he faced in college, you know, typically an end, you know, might weigh 240 pounds, you know, some of them maybe 210, a couple of them maybe 280 that were kind of big and lumbering. You know, when he goes into guard, he's got to learn new footwork, but he's going to be facing a 320-pound, you know, manimal. And so that's going to be an adjustment. But he clearly has all the skills. He's got good feet. And the best part I like about him is he's ultra-competitive and he loves to finish.
Thoughts on Rackley from what you've heard?
Yeah, the only thing, as Jeff was describing him, I kept thinking back to the conversation I had with his coach right after the draft. And the coach... Of course, he's going to praise his guy, but over and over and over again, he's telling me stories about this kid's dedication, about how even when he came in as a freshman, he had the goal of being here from day one, and a lot of college football players want to play in the NFL. This was a kid who not only had the goal, but he's one of those every waking moment kids, I call him, where that's what they did and that's what they worked toward, and anything he had to do to get here, he was going to do. A lot of guys say that. Not everybody's actually willing to do what it takes to do it. I think when you combine that with what Jeff saw, you know, Gene Smith guy, I mean, I would think.
The nice thing about him is, Brian, the game that I saw that they played against Villanova, they got hammered by Villanova. And they run, Lehigh ran some variation of the spread offense, and they rotated two quarterbacks, number 12 and number 15. Like I said, I don't know who they are. They were terrible. Interceptions all over the place. And they were down 21-0 against Villanova, and Rackley was still playing like they had a lead, and he was out to squash guys.
Right.
And to me, that says a lot about a guy when the team is getting hammered and it's 2 minutes to go in the fourth quarter and you're down by 21. What kind of effort are you giving? And Rackley was giving effort like it was the first snap of the game and finishing like it was the first snap of the game.
Let's talk about the guard position then. You've got Uche Nwaneri. You've got Vinny Manawa. You've got Justin Smiley. Now you throw a Will Rackley into the mix. I mean, evaluate the position in the competition that we'll see when camp opens.
I think clearly this year, you know, Vince cemented his spot last year with the way that he really got back to the old Vince form. Uche has pretty much cemented himself. The question becomes now about Justin Smiley. And Justin Smiley's, you know, if his cap number's not high, and I don't know what it is, then, you know, four guards is a possibility. If that's not a possibility, then you're going to go with the younger guy. The one thing that I will say about Rackley's adjustment is that most offensive linemen have a very tough adjustment period to the NFL in pass protection because a lot of them haven't done it. At Lehigh, that's all he did, and he did it at the tackle spot. So that should shorten what typically is the toughest adjustment for an offensive lineman is pass protection, hands, footwork, and stuff because the guy clearly has all those tools. But I think the size and the speed is going to be an adjustment. And for anybody, you know, coming out of even a major college program, and it's an adjustment.
So if he had come in on a normal schedule, do you think he would have been able to compete to play this year, or was he always going to be behind?
No, I think this year he was going to be behind.
Okay,
you know, and I don't even if he had all that time, I mean, you got two really good players in Vince and Uche, and you've got a third really good player in Justin Smiley. You know, and I don't know if they will or not, but, boy, the NFL needs to look at expanding the rosters. You know, they talked about it just for the purpose of having 18 games, but I wish the NFL would expand the rosters anyway.
A couple spots?
Yeah. I mean, why not, you know? So he's gonna be on the roster, you know, barring injury, he's going to be on the roster. And so now the question becomes what formula will they have at offensive line as far as numbers go? You know, how many are they going to keep? Rackley has, you know, reps at tackle, and so could he be a swing guy? He's not short. I mean, if you put him on the Pittsburgh Steelers in the tackle meeting, you wouldn't think that he was too short or looked like a guard. You know, so, I mean, here's a guy that's got value because he's played left tackle throughout his college career. Maybe they think that he's a guard eventually, but certainly has value on game day because he can play inside and out.
And you've got guys like Kevin Haslam and Daniel, yeah, I forget his
Baldridge.
Name. Baldridge. I was going to say Baldinger, but I mean, you got some young guys that were there that you at least thought last year had the developmental capacity.
Yeah, I think that when you consider that Haslam, Smiley, and then Baldridge were kind of added last year, and then you add what Rackley to that mix, and then two really young tackles. This is a young ascending, talented offensive line
John
that's
Estes,
very deep, and John Estes at center. So that may be the most interesting cut when we finally get back to football. That may be the most interesting position to watch this year in training camp because that's going to be tough.
All right, folks, we need a break. 355 NFL 1. One more segment, Jaguars This Week, presented by Aetna, only from Everbank Field and only on News Talk Radio, WOKV. Depend on it. All right, about 9 minutes left in the show. Sexton, Loggeman, Osher, Fortunato, 355 NFL 1 if we want to add your name to the mix. Back to the business side of it for just a moment. When it does open, now we're talking about that 90% floor, teams are going to have to spend money. And they're going to spend a lot of money. And when free agency opens, there's going to be a lot of players in the market. And we've seen Jeff Ireland down in Miami made the comment earlier this week to the media down there, it's going to be a frenzy. It's going to be crazy.
And you're going to see, you know, you always see mistakes made in free agency. And I'm sure you're going to see, you know, more and more expensive mistakes, which is, you know, a problem.
So some guys are going to get paid because the team has to spend money.
Yeah, and you
don't have any other options.
The hard part about discussion of free agency is that how many teams have come out and said, we're going to be very active in free agency? I mean, a bunch.
Right.
This team is one of them.
Yeah, I mean, Carolina, Jacksonville, Miami. I mean, just to name a few in the Southeast that, you know, that we hear quite often about. But, I mean, holy cow. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Redskins are talking about jumping in. The Cardinals are talking about jumping in free agency. Maybe some of the teams that won't be active in free agency. Pittsburgh, just traditionally, they just don't do that. But, I mean, even the New Englands are talking about jumping into free agency because their salary cap is so healthy, even though they got to worry about their quarterback somewhat. I mean, to me, where's the money going? I mean, if this goes through as talked about, this may be the best year to ever be a free agent.
Yeah, oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
You would have loved that.
Yeah, because there's some guys on those lists that you can tell are going to get paid that, I don't know.
Whether they're worth it or not.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah.
And will you have enough time
For them to come into your system.
Hey, look, Gene Smith, I know, you know, has done every conceivable scenario that could possibly come up. I mean, that's just Gene. Never unprepared for anything. But will somebody else's lack of preparation drive the price, you know, of somebody that they really covet through the roof, you know, that what they thought that here's a really good price for this guy, and some team jumps in and we got to have him. We got to make a splash. We got to sell tickets. We got to get names.
Well, then you're going to see the other side of that become, okay, you go after your guy. You go after the, you know, defensive end you want. He signs somewhere else. All of a sudden, you're paying somebody who's a second choice and building that guy up like he's a first choice, paying him way more. I think it's going to happen a lot, and there's going to be a lot of mistakes.
That'll also affect the franchise player tag on somebody, right?
Eventually, sure.
Yeah, to me, this may be the most interesting short, you know, off season that's ever happened in the NFL. I mean, if this gets done the way everybody's expecting it to happen, at some point in July, you know, the doors open for business and things get rolling. I mean, holy cow. I mean, put the seatbelt on and hold on.
And do you reach a point if you're the Jaguars where you've said all offseason, we're going to be active, do you reach a point where if you don't get one or two guys that can help you, where it becomes smarter to say, we've got to go with what we've got? You know, fans aren't going to like that, but in the long run, it's better. You know, you don't want to sign a guy if you can't play.
Right.
And if you just miss on two or three because that guy wants to sign somewhere else, are you better off not going after that fourth guy who can't play, but the fans know, you know, all of a sudden that's what always has caused bad free agency mistakes. Not here, but everywhere.
Right. So just to now stay business but turn to rookies, one of the things that we've talked about is a rookie salary cap. They've had one. Of course, when you give a quarterback $50 million, it doesn't look like they have one. So where does that stand, and where should it be?
Brian, that's maybe the thing that you know, the money man for this team and other teams that drafted, you know, Minnesota, Tennessee, Carolina, that all had quarterbacks in the first round, they're wanting to see what this rookie salary model is going to be. You know, the Jaguars are going to be dealing with Tom Condon, Blaine Gabbert's agent. Tom Condon, you know, when he has a quarterback,
they get paid.
You know, that can be tough.
It's Peyton Manning's agent.
That is going to be very interesting to see what happens with the rookie pay scale, because the Jaguars have to sign a top 10 pick quarterback.
What do you think? Having been a veteran in this game, what's fair?
I think it's fair. I certainly thought that it was fair after 1989 that the rookie should have had a very, you know,
right after you
tough cap.
Give me mine. Now let's put it on.
No, but I mean, they've got to do something. I mean, the percent has grown disproportionately throughout the years as compared to the salary cap. I'm all for guys, you know, making money based on merit and what they did in college and how they're picked. There's no question that they have to make more money the higher that they're picked. But when you've got top five picks that are getting guaranteed money of 50, 60, and I think Sam Bradford was in the $70 million range.
Yeah, I think it was.
That's insanity. I mean, the guy that was with Oakland, the purple drink quarterback.
$39 million. Yeah, Jamarcus Russell.
I mean.
He got $39 million guaranteed.
$39 million guaranteed. You know, and I read a quote this week from Terrell Suggs, and he obviously is for a little bit more control on the rookie pay scale, and because he got his already, which partly, you know, I understand that. But, I mean, he made a great point in that if you control that a little bit, then the rookies come in with their hard hat on, ready to go to work, and probably more committed to working harder to get that real contract the second time around. To me, I've been a big believer in a more stringent rookie pay cap, and then letting free agency happen earlier, mm-hmm. You know, after year three. You know, and the owners continue to fight it, and I just don't see why. I mean, they've been able to keep guys, you know, past their fourth year prior to this latest jump to fifth year
right.
of free agency. They've been able to keep their own in that model. And why wouldn't they want to take less risk financially to pay a guy that would be worth it after his third year? But, I mean, that's not going to happen because you still have some of the guard that says, well, we can't lose guys after year three, after we invest time and develop them. And, hey, they'll find a way to keep them. You negotiate with them after year two if yeah. need be. But, I mean, that's something that all the franchises that drafted quarterbacks in round one, they are going to be going, please control the rookie cap.
Make it hard.
Then it becomes easier to deal with the Tom Condon.
Right. Final thought, Peyton Manning needs a contract done, right?
Yes, he does.
And there's talk that there might be a proviso that the guys who are named in that lawsuit could become free agents. Not that he's going anywhere.
Right.
But
I think
leverage.
That's a big reason why they volunteered their names to be on that. They saw what happened with the Reggie White deal.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Those guys got, they couldn't get franchised after that point. And, so it's maybe that's why we saw Tom Brady, Drew Brees, Peyton Manning all right there as named plaintiffs.
Right.
What's Peyton's franchise number? 28 million?
Yeah. Very. Right.
$28 million.
Yeah. My understanding is he would not be averse to playing for the franchise tag 1 year.
Why would he be?
Well, some guys get very upset about it, but I think he could live with that.
He's made plenty of money in his career. $28 million in 1 year is worth waiting another year
sure.
for a deal, especially at the rate
sure.
he gets it.
And he realistically, even if he plays for it 1 year, he's got enough left in the tank to get a contract over 3 or 4 years. So,
well, the only issue he has is the neck, right? If that's even an issue.
Right. Other than that, he's...
Have you heard anything on that?
No, not where it's debilitating.
Okay. Right, I was just hoping.
Right.
Spoken like a true defensive end. Thanks, Osh. See you, Logs. Goodbye, Joe.